ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Books to love, books to reject, stories to celebrate, and those that make you roll your eyes that anyone, anywhere cares. Well, really, these are the passionate conversations about books that work for me. Hi there, I'm Kate Evans, and this is your Summer Bookshelf here on ABC Radio National, which this week comes from the 2025 Sydney Writers' Festival. It was a special live program with Claire Nichols from The Book Show, our sister program. I really do hope that you're following both of these shows, on air as well as on the ABC Listen app, and even on the ABC Book Club Facebook group. Because we also work together to bring you the ABC Top 100 Books Countdown. And this event you're about to hear was one of the ones that kicked it off, with a panel of writers from around the world. Alan Hollinghurst, Catherine Chidgey, Mariana Enriquez, and, to get things started, Emirati poet, scholar and artist Dr. Afra Atiq. Well, she joined us on stage. She writes in Arabic, French and English, and she kicks things off for us with a poem.
At some point you will be told there is no point. No one reads anymore. That if you put a book on a shelf, no one will look at it twice. They will tell you that being a poet is not a proper job description. But we have seen writers turn worlds into bridges, languages leaning towards the sun, kalimat, to harak al-khayal in every possible direction. Still, you will hear that no one reads anymore. There is no point or reason for poems, no shore of sea of syllables set against a backdrop of art. Uma fi da'i lil-wazn wal-qafiya, yet we know better. We know better than to look at the sky and not see the makings of a story. We look at the earth and see the beginnings of a ghaf tree, leaves like chapters outstretched, like echoes. Somewhere, my students ask me, why do you write? And honestly, I don't know. But I can't let them know this. So instead, I tell them I write because I must, because 7-year-old me wanted to be a novelist and 15-year-old me did not believe she was always a poet, and 30-something me. 30-something-year-old me hangs out with the publishers, and somewhere, بعيداً عن المعتاد, and all of this, there is a story. Somewhere, a palm tree and a poet. Somewhere, there is language. There is always language. We must learn to write because we must write beginning, middle, and end, narrative and story, pages and pages under breeze and sky, pages and pages planted, roots immovable in the many directions of somewhere and don't. All good stories begin and end, بداية ونهاية. Somewhere. Thank you. Oh.
Afra Atiq, and that poem was called Roots in the Direction of Somewhere, and it's from the collection of Palm Trees and Skies. And that has already, I guess, given us an entree into the writers on the stage, into the whole idea of what we're doing, Claire.
So why don't we meet our guests here on the bookshelf? We have writers from England, from Argentina, and from New Zealand. Starting with Sir Alan Hollinghurst, he's an English writer and a Booker winner. His novels include The Swimming Pool Library, The Sparsholt Affair, The Line of Beauty, and his latest, Our Evenings.
And Mariana Enriquez is an Argentinian journalist and writer whose books include the novel Our Share of Night and the short story collections The Dangers of Smoking in Bed and, fantastic title, A Sunny Place for Shady People.
So good. And Catherine Chidgey is from New Zealand. She's a writer and an academic. Her books include In a Fishbone Church, The Axeman's Carnival, another great title, and The Book of Guilt. Can you please welcome them all?
Hi,
And today, for those of you in the room here at Sydney Writers Festival, we want to hear from you. What are your top books of the 21st century? So we've got a little QR code you can use here. Submit the book that you think is the best book of the 21st century. Submit to if you want, and you can upvote them. So as we talk today, we're going to keep hearing about how the vote is going in the room while we've got this conversation going too.
And we're ignoring all of those pedantic questions about exactly when the 21st century began. We have decided that it begins on the 1st of January in the year 2000 and goes up to the end of August this year. But back to our distinguished guests on stage, I wonder if we could get a sense of each of you as writers before we explore your reading selves. So, Mariana Enriquez, All Things Uncanny, Disconcerting, Ghastly and Violent. Is that a fair description of what you do?
Yeah. Hello. Yes.
Why? It is.
That's how my mind works. And yes, that horror and disquieting things were the best to describe how I was feeling and how I interpret reality. It's not that I'm bleak in my view of things, but I'm fun too, I don't know. And anyway, horror was my favorite reading growing up. But the books I picked were always horror books. I liked all kinds of books, but let's say I was on the library and I like The Turn of the Screw, Henry James, and I was like, whoa, this is amazing. And probably, and Borges after, I'm from Argentina, so he can be very creepy. And that, I don't know, it was really entertaining. I don't think a writer chooses what he writes about or what he likes.
But it's look forward to hearing what that means for your reading as well. Thank you, Marianne. Yeah.
Alan Hollinghurst, your novels explore the gay history of England. Your latest, Our Evenings, a lot of reviewers are saying it's your best novel yet. Does it feel like the culmination of something for you, Alan?
It's a continuation to me, not a culmination. And various reviews of this book said, probably Hollinghurst's last novel. And I thought, damn, you know, it's absolutely... Well, actually, I had rather been thinking of retiring, but now I've absolutely so much to carry on. Yeah.
But, I mean, this is obviously a passion of yours, right, to explore the gay history.
Yeah, I sort of gave myself that task at the beginning and sort of felt I was wonderfully lucky, actually. This was something which hadn't really been explored in British literary fiction, and here was this amazingly interesting area of both of history and of present experience, which I just sort of took as my subject.
And it is such a wonderful whole life story, Our Evenings as well, your latest one. It's such a beautiful book. But Catherine Chidji, your latest novel, Book of Guilt, you've written a sort of alternative history of the 20th century with children who are experimented on in an uncanny way. It almost reflects back to what Mariana was saying about sort of horror and the disconcerting nature of something, of identity. How much is this book, how much does it reflect all of your writing?
I'm often accused of trying something different with each new book, and that my books are quite hard to pigeonhole. I don't see that as a problem. Why wouldn't I want to try something new each time? And I definitely don't want to write books that are just based on my own boring experience. I do see this book as growing out of two earlier novels that I wrote, both of which were set in Nazi Germany, The Wish Child and Remote Sympathy. And this book is set in an alternative version of England in 1979, but that particular setting has grown out of an early end to the war and to a treaty that was agreed upon and the sharing of research that was conducted during the war. So although it's mapped very closely to the real England in 1979, it has this dark history as well, bubbling away in the margins.
It's a delicious book. But Kate, we are here today to talk about reading. So we have asked our panellists today, in the spirit of the Top 100 Books Countdown, to nominate 5 books each, their top books of the 21st century. We're going to find out what they love, and maybe it can get our brains bubbling away for what we might like to vote for in the countdown when it kicks off in September. Mariana Enriquez, what's your take on lists like this where we try to rank books? Do you see a value in them?
Yeah, I love lists. I like that they are random and I like they make no sense. I like that we're making or you're making a list of the, you know, best 21st century books in 2025, so you don't really know in 30 years what's going to happen, like no world anymore or something. And
she said she was dark.
Yeah. And then I like that it sparks conversation. Like everybody's like, no, that's not there. That shouldn't be there. That is garbage. So we get talking about books. Of course, lists. I mean, they're silly, but what's silly is what's nice about it.
Yes, so a whole silly national project. You're part of this. Yes. Ellen Hollinghurst, how difficult is it to look back over a reading life and try to decide what has mattered to you?
I find it was very difficult. I'm a very slow reader and a very kind of disorganised one. And I did look at the New York Times' list of the 100 best books of the 21st century, and I found I'd read about four of them. So I feel sort of culpably out of unqualified to be on this programme. What I've done, as I will explain in a minute, is sort of just chosen books which were significant to me as a writer. A couple of them from writers of an older generation who I'd learnt from, but also I think that something which people perhaps don't talk about so much, which is how an older writer learns from the experiments that are being made by younger writers.
Catherine Chidgey, why don't you kick us off? You've nominated five books. There's one you're very excited to share with us. Talk to us about a favourite you really want us to know about.
Sure. So this is a work of creative nonfiction, which is that slippery genre that seems to be having quite a moment. And it's called The Lifespan of a Fact, and it's a collaboration between two writers, John Dagatar and Jim Fingal. And it grew out of an essay that John Dagatar wrote, he was commissioned to write for Harper's Magazine. And the essay talks about Las Vegas as the suicide capital of the United States, but in particular focuses on a young man, Levi Presley, who jumps to his death from the Stratosphere, which is the tallest building on the Strip in Las Vegas. Harper's rejected it because they said it was too problematic in terms of the facts of the piece and what John Dagatar had tried to bend or exaggerate or change for the purposes of writing a dramatic story. So then it was sold to the magazine The Believer, and they took on an intern, Jim Fingal, to fact check it. And that process took 7 years. So the book is laid out in a really interesting way. So on the page down the middle, in a column in black, you get the essay as it was finally, as it was submitted. And around that in red, you get the fact checker's queries. And there are a lot of them, enough to, you know, to fill a whole book. So, for instance, it starts out on the very first page with John Dagatar writing that on the day of Levi Presley's death, there was a ban on lap dancing in Las Vegas. And Jim Fingal has looked into this and says, well, no, in fact, there was talk of a possible ban of touching strippers. So it's not quite as you're presenting it. And right from the first page, these two men are really locking horns, and it gets increasingly heated as the book progresses and really quite bitchy between the two of them.
That sounds great.
What's the pleasure in actually seeing the process on the page?
That's the thing that really interests me about this book. Normally that editorial process is hidden away. We are not party to it at all. Here we see behind the scenes and this kind of wrangling, this back and forth tussle between, on the one hand, the writer who sees himself as an essayist, not as a writer of nonfiction. And the fact checker, on the other hand, whose job it is to say, well, really, that van that you're talking about was pink, not purple. And John Dagatar says, yeah, but for the rhythm of the sentence, I need to say purple.
And thank you so much for that example and for reminding us of the slipperiness of genre as well. And I think, as you say, creative nonfiction is so dynamic a form. And as you know, we are collecting some of your suggestions. Can I make a request? When you put in a book that you want to recommend, can you had the author's name. Somebody has already mentioned The Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. I know it's written by Michael Chabon. You hadn't put his name. I'll be very embarrassed if you put some great book there and I cannot remember who wrote it. Now, let's keep on going with our specialist readers on stage. Mariana Enriquez, what would you like to add to this shared list?
I had 12 books and I narrowed down to 6 and now they asked me to choose one, so this is very stressful. It's 2666 by Roberto Bolaño. Mm-hmm. It's too long to explain to you what is it about, but probably the facts of how this book came published are more important to see why it's very important. Roberto was a writer from Chile. He moved from Chile during the some moment of the Chilean dictatorship of Pinochet. That was all obviously very long. And he moved to Mexico and he ended up living in Barcelona. That on its own, to me, speaks volumes about the different kinds of Spanish that we as Latin Americans deal with. It's very different to talk in Chile than to speak in Mexico, than to speak in Spain, in every sense. And it's not like it's not going to be obvious. If I start speaking in Chileno, Mexicano, and Español, you will tell the difference. And also talks about the experience of migration and of exile in the case of and of diaspora in the case of Latin America that I find very interesting. Also, it's a very, very long book, and it's a book that comes out after his massive hit and the book that changed the game for writing in Latin America, that is The Savage Detectives, that I would choose that, but it's from the 90s. And this book he wrote when he was dying. He was dying of pancreatic cancer at 50-something. But what's interesting about the book is that it's like he wrote it. He was dying, but it's not nothing like that, you know, things that we say usually is very urgent, it's very, you know, he was with time. No, it's like he has all the time in the world. There are long things about writers and this and that, and it goes nowhere, and it's full of branches, and it's like, I don't need to rush. If I die, I die. So he had 5 books, and he wanted to publish them, but he died before telling the editor how. So it's a bit of a Frankenstein.
5 separate books,
5
right?
Separate, yeah. Books, yeah. But he had a lot of ideas, and he was weird. And they decided to publish it as one book, and it makes a lot of sense. He really trusted his editor. It's not like they made him wrong. And yeah, it's a very it's very playful with the language. It absolutely gives you the sense of Latin America, but not in the sense of stereotypical wonder or all those kinds of wide-eyed things that doesn't exist to us anymore. It's very bookish. And it's amazing, and it's long, and it's threatening, because you see it, and it's like, I have to do that. And
That was a face of shock for those listening at
home.
And
yeah, I love it. I mean, Spanish is the second language spoken in the planet, right? So whatever is like a massive book of fiction of a great writer that comes from there, something like that. Like it's a testament, let's say, and it's not a solemn testament. It's just playful and crazy.
Mariana Enriquez recommending the playful and crazy work of Roberto Bolaño. You're listening to a summer edition of ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf, with me, Kate Evans, with Claire Nichols from The Book Show, and with guests Mariana Enriquez, Alan Hollinghurst and Catherine Chigi. This edition of The Bookshelf was broadcast live from the Sydney Writers' Festival, and we'd asked each of the guests to make a selection of their own best books of the 21st century. Not easy, as we all know. And I promise, Mariana, that we will make sure that we whip through all the other books on the list as well. But Alan Hollinghurst, we asked you this huge question. You narrowed it down to 5, but which one are you going to start off with for us?
I'm going to start with Runaway, which is a collection of stories by the great late Alice Munro. A book by her, The Beggar Maid, was the first book I ever reviewed in the kind of public press. And I was very, very struck by it. And it wasn't a novel, it was a collection of stories, but they were all about the same group of people. And that fascinated me very much. And I sort of carried on after that reading everything that she published. Runaway is a book of stories written in her 70s, and in her later work, she's got this longer period to look back over. And I think she's an absolutely wonderful writer at economically dropping into moments in the past. She understands this crucial thing that people in the past do not have any sense of their quaintness to the future. I think often historical fiction suffers from a surfeit of fact and research, and it's so easy to research things now, and historical writers try to lend authenticity to what they're writing by showing all the research in the book. But she has the absolute confidence to do none of that. She just tells you a story that's taking place in 1920 or something as if it was happening today. And that's something which I've tried to emulate myself in writing novels which sort of drop into episodes sometimes 50 or 60 years ago.
We noticed how often in your list you seem to be drawn to short fiction.
Yes, that's right. I hadn't quite realised that as I made the list. And I think it's because I have this terrible habit of dilating myself. I always long to write a really short book and tell my publisher it will be probably 230 pages.
And You've never done that, have you?
And it ends up being 560 pages. So I sort of revere this power of concentration which short story writers tend to have.
You are listening to The Bookshelf here on ABC Radio National with me, Claire Nichols, and with Kate Evans, and with our fabulous guests, Alan Hollinghurst, Mariana Enriquez, and Catherine Chidgey, coming to you live from the Sydney Writers' Festival. And for us lucky people here in the room, we are nominating our favourite books. I'm loving seeing all these titles come through. I'm going to read you the top five so far. A Prophet's Song, Paul Lynch, fantastic, harrowing. I think that would be right up your alley, Mariana. An Australian book is coming in second at the moment, Kate Grenville's Secret River. The Book Thief by Marcus Suzak, 20 years old this year. We also have The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt. Oh, and Bel Canto has just crept up by Anne Patchett. That is on my list of the day I stop working for the book show. That's the first book I'm going to read, Bel Canto. So many people's favourite book.
And I think The Road, Mariana, is one of the books that that you had on your list.
Yep. I love Cormac McCarthy, so I had to put one of his, and I'm very happy that was in the 2000s.
2006,
because that's a book, for those that you haven't read, it's a very sparse, short book that for Cormac McCarthy those days was kind of very different to what he was doing, because he was writing the Bible up to then. And then he came with this very sharp, tense, muscle, post-apocalyptic novel about a father and a son in the end of the world trying to go to the sea. That's it. But what happens there, everything that happens there is so amazing. And the main issue that he's talking about, I think, is what the responsibility of being a parent, what it means, taking care of someone in a world that is dying. It's about guilt and it's about love, because he wants to preserve he wants to care about the boy, and he can't because he's dying too. I ruined the ending for you anyway. But it doesn't matter, because it's what happens in the book. And it has two or three incredibly zombie, bleak scenes that you would never think that would appear in literary fiction. And of a writer of the stature of Cormac McCarthy, and of the style and of the, I don't know, mood of Cormac McCarthy, that he was such a grave kind of man. And this could have been written by... You can make a video game of this, which is it's pretty amazing, because it shows you that he was very much in touch with what's around him. And I don't know, it's massively influential for writers, and it's and also it's a book of his late life, and based, I think, on the experience of being a man in his 70s having a very young child, which was like, what have I done here? But I don't know, it's wonderful, it's scary.
It is scary, and it is one of those novels that so many other writers have spoken to me about, including the Irish writer Paul Lynch, as well. I know that he's very influenced by
by the road.
We're in kind of a dystopian mood here. So I'm wondering, Catherine, if you can tell us about one of the books on your list, The Chimes by the New Zealand writer Anna Smail?
Anna Smail. Yes, so it was her debut novel. It was longlisted for the Booker in 2015. She was already a published poet, and also she's a classically trained violinist. And I think you can see poetry and music influencing this novel. So it's set in a dystopian future England where there is no written word. The written word has been erased, outlawed, and people have no memories. Every day their memories are obliterated by this gigantic musical instrument that plays these chimes at the same time every day. And from that point on, people can no longer retain what happened to them that day. The thing that I really love about this book is that it's kind of set in no time. So we know that it's set in the future because of how it talks about everything that's been lost. But at the same time, it feels like the people are existing in this almost medieval world. And I think it's such a clever decision on the part of Anna Smail to present time like that, because the people in this world are existing in this kind of nothingness, this void. If you don't have memory and if you don't have the written word, then you don't know who you are or where you are. And that's what I think makes it such a powerful novel.
I also think it was just so inventive to use language and sound as a defining force in this story. But also, thank you for reminding us that in Australia in particular, I think we should be paying attention to what's written in New Zealand and the Pacific, and thinking about how literature works there. But Claire, shall you give us a bit of an update on what's happening in the room?
I'm feeling a bit parochial, so can I run through the Australian picks on the list so far?
Be as parochial as you like, Claire.
Oh, fantastic. So at the top of the list right now is Marcus Susak's The Book Thief. I reread that this year. It just keeps giving, that book. It is so glorious. Secret River still up there. We have The Dictionary of Lost Words by Pip Williams. That's some nice size in the audience. We all love that book. Lola in the Mirror by Trent Dalton. And I think I saw... Oh, thank you to whoever submitted Limber Lost by Robbie Arnott. That is one of my personal picks. And actually, because Kate and I have made our lists as well with a bit of an Australian focus, this is torture for Kate Evans.
Oh, it just kills me. I look at that list that I made in, I think, October last year. What was I thinking? And what was I forgetting? Yeah. Like, The Road wasn't on it. Like, how did I even do that?
But yes, Too Much Lip by Melissa Lukashenko is a book that was on both of our lists. We absolutely adore that novel. Yeah, so fantastic to have some great Aussie picks coming through. And Alan Hollinghurst, you have an Australian novel on your list. Appeal to the audience here. Tell us what you love.
I wanted to pay homage to the great Peter Carey. And I think there was a little bit of quibbling about this, but I think we agreed that The True History of the Kelly Gang was just published in the...
It just 21st, sneaks in. It got the Booker Prize in 2001. It
counts. Exactly. Yeah. That's what I thought. You know, I could equally have talked about, if we were pushing it back a little bit further, about Oscar and Lucinda, one of my absolute favourite books. I mean, I revere his abundance of imagination, of his linguistic imagination. And, you know, he's a great finder of likenesses. He's like, I mean, he's often been likened himself to Dickens, and this incredible fertility of metaphor and simile and the sort of richness of the apprehended world and inventiveness of language. And that's what makes The Kelly Gang such a fascinating sort of book for him, because of he set himself this extraordinary technical challenge of expanding. Do you pronounce it Geraldery? Geraldery letter, the one thing that Ned Kelly wrote at the end of his life, this very brief testament. And he takes that as a kind of template for the prose of an extended novel, which could be, you know, a very dreary and limited thing, but by a kind of alchemy, he expands it without ever feeling untrue to the voice of his narrator into something which attains great sort of poetic heights. I was completely knocked out by that book when I read it.
Alan, do you ever read a book and think, God, I wish I wrote that. God, I'm jealous of that.
I'm not jealous, actually. I think I'm quite a nice person than I And I rejoice in the achievements of my fellow writer.
What about you, Mariana? I mean, you like the deep and the dark there. So do you look at other writers and go, oh, I wish I'd done that, or I could have done it better?
No, I'm nice too. That's
such a lovely panel today. Yeah.
For the record, Catherine, are you also
really
lovely?
Jealous. I'm super, super jealous. I seethe behind the scenes.
At least someone here is honest. You also picked an Australian novel, Catherine Chidgey, another Melissa Lukashenko novel. What did you choose?
Yes, I chose Eden Glassy by Melissa Lukashenko, which seems unstoppable in the prizes that it's scooping up. It was my first introduction to her work, and I can't wait to read too much lip now as well. So I'm sure most of you are already familiar with this phenomenal book, but it tells, it has a dual timeline, so set in the 1850s, telling the story of a Gori man, Mulanyan, and the woman he falls in love with, Nita, who is a servant for a white colonialist, Tom Petrie, who's a real historical figure. And then it has a present-day strand concerning a woman called Granny Eddy, who may or may not be Queensland's oldest Aboriginal, but the journalists are really hoping that they can sort of present her as such. And she is in constant conversation with her firebrand granddaughter, Winona. And the book sort of looks at how to deal with the ongoing impact of colonisation. And Granny Eddy favours taking a more moderate approach, whereas Winona wants to, you know, burn everything down. And it sounds kind of weighty, and it is, but it's also really funny. There's an amazing scene where Winona goes up to a white busker who's playing the didgeridoo, and he has his pale dreads, and she just grabs it off him and starts to, you know, basically attack him with it.
I love the way that Melissa Lukashenko is, the voice on the page is so authentic, so playful, so fun. And speaking of voice, Kate Evans, we might move into books in translation now.
A great suggestion there from the Book Show's Claire Nichols. But before we take it up that we should talk about books in translation, how about I remind you what you're listening to? This edition of Radio National's The Bookshelf was recorded live on stage in May 2025 at the Sydney Writers' Festival. The context? We were setting things up for the Top 100 Books Countdown and asking a bunch of international writers about their own reading influences. I'm Kate Evans, hosting this discussion with Claire Nichols and our guests, Catherine Chidgey, Alan Hollinghurst and Mariana Enriquez, who was a tad stressed by her list. But Mariana, I mean, there is a book in translation on your list from the Salvadorian writer, Senselessness. Can you tell us about that one?
Horacio Castellanos Mocha is the writer. That is a very short book, about 100 and some pages, and it's about this is a genre that I really, really, really sometimes don't like, that it's a book about a writer. I mean, books about writers are boring unless they're by Stephen King. Like, Misery is great, right? But most of it is like they have nothing left to say and, you know, and just talk about their experience. But this one is, he gets a university in the US ask him to write something using as material the testimony of Aboriginals that were massacred in Guatemala and El Salvador. And he feels absolutely disgusted about himself because he's this Latin American writer using the misery of the people that lived in his same land for an American university that is going to be so pleased with itself to say, oh, we are giving voice to these people. So he starts doing it because he wants to run away from his country too. And then he feels he's using the voice of these people to get advantage. So he goes completely insane. And he's on campus doing the most despicable things because he needs to hate himself because of what he's doing. And he's also very haunted by these voices of the dead that he's transcribing and that are transcribed also in the book. So the book is a bit of a mixture of voices of his first person narrative, of those real life testimony of those voices, and also of the voice of the people that are looking at him and how he's pretending to be okay and to being okay with this deed that he took only because of the money and because of the possibility of running away. So I think it's a very interesting place where experience is not of the writer is not like uplifting, but it's kind of, this is the things you have to do. It's an amazing book.
It sounds absolutely incredible. And it makes me think about the way we choose the books that make this list, if it's about the way it makes you feel, if it's about the beauty of the sentences, or if it's about the importance of the content of this book. And this is something I'd love to hear from each of you.
Yeah.
Like, what is it that makes a book magic for you and makes it kind of rocket to the top of that list? Catherine, can you say?
I think it's books that I can't stop thinking about, the ones that really stick with me and the ones that I keep asking myself questions about. So, for instance, with The Lifespan of Effect, I don't know which side of the debate I fall on, whether you are able to manipulate the facts to tell a good story or whether you should stick only to the true story. So it's those books that make me keep wondering. And also the ones that I admire from a craft point of view, the ones where I do think, God damn it, I wish I'd written that or I wish I'd had that idea.
Alan?
I think the craft thing is very important, yes. I like a sense of kind of aesthetic uplift from reading and a sense of being transported and held in another place. As I was saying, I'm very sort of distractible. So a book which, I mean, I've just read two wonderful first novels because of I was going to be on panels with their authors, Detransition Baby by Tori Peters and The Safe Keep by Yael van der Woerden, both of which I found completely sort of compelling. That's the kind of experience that I'm after. I think I don't think it is so much to do with the successful mastery of huge themes and so on. And I think as a writer, I'm looking for a particular kind of sort of linguistic and technical satisfaction.
And one book that I know, like it has stopped me in my tracks just from the beauty, well, the beauty of individual sentences and then, as she herself says, the importance is that the sentences stack next to each other. So paragraphs of sheer beauty. And that is in the work of Irish writer Claire Keegan, which, Alan, you have her books on your list as well. So which of her works and why?
Well, I fudged it and chose both of her, both of her sort of the novellas, really. I think they were both first published, Foster and Small Things Like These, as sort of stories in magazines and slightly expanded after. I read Small Things Like These first, a breathtakingly good book of very, very concentrated, but without any sense of sort of forcing or... it's a large book, in a very small compass, with a superbly sort of handled development of a very dark subject. It's written in the third person. And I then went back and read her earlier book, Foster, about a girl who was sent away for a while from her home in Ireland to stay with another couple who've lost, it turns out, have lost a child. That's written in the first person and has a much more subjective quality. But again, this richness of apprehension in an extremely controlled small format. And I think they're both masterpieces.
Yes, and the way that she pairs things back is just breathtaking. And just a reminder that this is The Bookshelf on ABC Radio National and on the ABC Listen app. We're here to launch our Top 100 Books special, this ongoing annual project for 2020, beginning in 2025. And to help us with this, we're joined today by the English chronicler of gay lives, Alan Hollinghurst, Argentinian creator of sexy gothic horror, Mariana Enriquez, and Catherine Chidgey, who also likes to unsettle us. And here we are at the Sydney Writers' Festival.
I'm Claire Nichols here with Kate Evans, and I am keeping an eye on the vote that's coming through. I feel like I'm at Eurovision. This is so exciting. I'm going to.
You should see what she's wearing.
I got dressed up for this occasion, but I want to mention a few new votes that have come in from the room, a few new books that have emerged. Still Life by Sarah Winman. What a popular novel that one is. A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles, one of my mum's favourite books. The Year of Wonder
by Geraldine Brooks.
Pachinko. We've got the Goldfinch. Yeah, we've got the Goldfinch by Donna Tartt, and a late emergence, Demon Copperhead by Barbara Kingsolver. That I thought that might go for the trifecta. I think it won the Pulitzer. It won the Nobel, I think, but it
Boy,
missed the Booker.
Would she be excited if she won this one?
Oh, yes. Let's do it. Top 100 books. That will be the trifecta. That will be what they're aiming for. But let's add some more books to the list. Let's talk memoir, because we haven't got into memoir. And Catherine Chidgey, you've chosen one of probably the most famous memoirs of all.
Yes, I couldn't go past The Year of Magical Thinking by Joan Didion. It's such a concentrated jewel, and takes us right into that experience of feeling as if bereavement makes you crazy, makes you lose your mind. And Didion, so for those of you who don't know the book, it's the story of how Didion loses her husband to cardiac arrest at their dinner table and has to grapple with grieving that loss while at the same time their daughter is in hospital in ICU and hovering between life and death. And the thing that I love about this memoir is that Joan Didion never sensationalizes her pain. Rather, she brings to that story the same incisiveness as she brings to her journalism and her other nonfiction. And in fact, one thing that she repeats throughout the book is, in difficult times, go to the literature, and you'll find comfort and you'll find order from chaos there. And this is what she tries to do when she tries to piece together exactly how her husband would have died. And if there's anything that she maybe could have changed after the fact in that crazy way, you know, this is the magical thinking of the title. If she can find out exactly what happened in the autopsy, could she have somehow gone back in time and changed it? And she thinks, well, the autopsy has happened in New York, but it hasn't happened in LA time yet, therefore he might still be alive. And it's so beautifully rendered without, as I say, any sensationalising or any melodrama.
I'm often taken by how much fiction as well grapples with grief. Mm. And Alan Hollinghurst, looking at the way that the writing of gay lies has changed over the last 40 or 50 years. I mean, there was a period when dealing with HIV/AIDS seemed sort of central to that literary project. How much did that change, the writing, the way that gay lives had to be written?
Well, I think, yes, there was this brief period of kind of exuberant exploration, which is the kind of the literature of gay lib, and I think of writers like Andrew Holleran and Edmund White in the States. And that exuberance was challenged by this terrible, unforeseen crisis of AIDS, which generated its own literature. I think those two periods together constituted a period when the gay novel sort of was a significant genre. It was doing something urgent and new, and with a, you know, considerable kind of political impetus as well. And as time went on, I mean, it's the interesting thing about writing about gay life is that it's very much a live subject, you know, so you don't know where it's going. And there are huge social shifts going on underneath all the time, generational shifts in attitude, legal changes. And so I think gay lit as a genre constituted in the sort of 70s and 80s sort of rather dissolved into other things and into much more subtle and complicated explorations of sexuality as well.
And what does that mean then for, I mean, you have chosen a younger gay writer in your your list. Who is it? Tell
us about it. This is Brian Washington, a brilliant young African-American writer, Houston-based. I taught for a while at the University of Houston, and so it had a certain nostalgic interest for me. But he wasn't writing about it from the kind of Houston, from the elite point of view of rich universities and so on, but from that of immigrant families living a very kind of hardscrabble life. And he published, he was only 23 or something, this extraordinary collection of short stories called Lot, which are mainly about a family. The father runs a restaurant. The son, it only slowly emerges, is gay. His elder brother is a sort of a bully. The mother wants to move away and stay with her family somewhere else. So it's about a world in transition, great hardship, brilliantly focused into these. It's very unusual, I think, for debut writers to have that degree of control and springing amazing sort of emotional and narrative surprises on you as well in a very short space. And I was completely knocked out by it. And he's gone on to write two novels which are more diffuse in nature, and which are written very much in an idiom which is full of everyday speech.
Family Meal, I think, is his latest one.
Yes, there's Memorial and then Family Meal. And they're both, again, have extraordinary moments of sort of revelation and very powerful.
Let's stick with queer literature. Mariana Enriquez, you've picked a book called The Sluts by Dennis Cooper. Tell us about this one.
Well, it's the one of... First, in my reading for education, let's say, when I was young, it was the moment of gay literature because it was the moment of AIDS. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was very important, especially, incredibly, the French writers, Hervé Guibert, especially Hervé Guibert, and Cyril Collard, and many like that. But Dennis Cooper appeared in this. He's a writer from San Francisco. He's in his 70s now, which is shocking to me because he was young when I started reading him. So
it's shocking to all of us.
Yeah. And I checked because, you know, I wanted to be one of them. And he's extremely what today we would call problematic. And because he really explores in the language and in the in what he writes about his darkest fantasies, but with a very clean approach to the writing. Like he's almost, the level of language is almost of the phatic language. Like it's like, hello, how you doing? Well, that kind of thing. And that book, The Sluts, is a book about bodies, but bodies are presented to us today in the digital world we live now, that is mostly by profiles on dating apps. So it's mostly done by this obsession that many men have with a boy that is prostituting himself on a dating app. And it's basically done with forums, I mean, with what you could call all kinds of materials that are not from literature. And this is something that Dennis always did because he comes from punk rock, he comes from the art world, he's an experimental writer. And I'm always interested in using tools and materials that are not specifically thought about as literature and making something out of that and showing in that book how destroyed languages by the fragmentation of the digital experience and how the body is destroyed there in all kinds. It's like a Frankenstein kind of book, and how desire is in this realm can go completely free and therefore completely dangerous. It's a marvelous book. It's not for the faint-hearted. It's like really, all his books are really edgy, and I think in another era, if it wasn't that he started writing and publishing in the 80s, he wouldn't be published at all. Like today, he wouldn't be published at all. And I really like literature that is dangerous, because literature in itself is not dangerous, it's just a book. So I get really upset when people are like, I'm not reading that. You don't have to read that. let us, the people that are daring, go and read that. It's okay.
I love this case for dangerous literature. All the books you've nominated, Mariana, they're challenging reads. You know, like Roberto Bolaño, that's not an easy read. Do you like a novel that asks the reader to work for it?
Yes. Before we were talking about if we choose craft or we choose themes, and I choose craft first. And I don't have the vocabulary to explain to you the craft. That's that important because I'm in translation too in my head. But I use, I really like challenge. I really like a book that I don't like the first time. This happened to me like with Virginia Woolf, for example. Everybody was like, oh, Virginia Woolf. And I think I got the wrong book because it was The Waves. And I started to say, this is nonsense. Like, what is this woman doing? And I went in translation to another one, Orlando, that was translated by Borges. And of course, Borges did whatever he wanted in translation. So it really didn't, it was bad also. And I almost gave up until To the Lighthouse when I finally got her. So I really like that. I don't give up in general. And I also like a challenge. If a book offends me, that's good because it's making me think. I don't like to be comforted. That's not literature. That's your family. That's your dog. That's hopefully the state. I don't know. You know, hopefully a good plane ride. That should be comforting clothes, but not art.
Fantastic, audacious reading. Audacious reading, challenging reading, reading that is urgent. We've only got a couple of minutes left. So, Catherine, Alan, fling your books down in front of us. Tell us why they matter in like 30 seconds or less. Alan Hollinghurst, David Soloy is on your list.
Yes, a brilliant writer. His book, All That Man Is, it is a novel. Again, it's this thing of a book being written as a sequence of apparently short stories, but it has this mysterious coherence as a novel. It was a great help to me, this book, and this is an instance of learning from younger writers when I was trying to write a novel which had a time span of about 80 years. And I saw you could put a book together with detached episodes, and his sort of technical bravura was amazing. And in his book, each of nine episodes features on a man who is older in each one. So it sort of tells the story of a whole life through sort of the experiences of nine diverse people. I was completely knocked out by that book. I think he's a genius.
And unfortunately, we only have about 30 seconds to hear about a Maori writer who is on your list, Catherine Chichi.
Yeah, so this is Tina Makariti's novel, The Imaginary Lives of James Ponike, which is based on the true story of a young Maori boy who is taken to London, Victorian London, and exhibited as a curiosity. I love this book because the narrator, James Ponike, turns the tables and gains an education, speaks like an Englishman, does not behave as the savage that people are coming to see. And it's a really clever book because Tina Makariti makes the watched watch back.
Okay, and we promise we will list all of these books on the bookshelf page. Claire, where are we up to in our
count in the room? We have, I'm going to tell you the top five books here on the count. Number five, Lola in the Mirror by Trent Dalton. Number four, The Book Thief by Marcus Suzak. Number three, The Secret River by Kate Grenville. What a great showing for Australian fiction there. Number two, Bel Canto by Anne Patchett. I will read it. And number one, Still Life by Sarah Winman.
Who has been here at the Sydney Writers' Festival in the past as well. So our to-be-read piles have grown even bigger. That's it for this week's edition of ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf.
And you'll be hearing a lot more about the top 100 books count here on Radio National in the weeks and months ahead.
Yes, so bring us your literary fiction, your crime stories, your fantasy, your life-changing works of political history. But first, many thanks to our reading guests, Alan Hollinghurst, Mariana Enriquez, Catherine Chidji, and also the poet Afra Atik.
My name is Claire Nichols.
And I'm Kate Evans. And make sure you follow both The Book Show and The Bookshelf anywhere. Keep reading, keep listening. We'll be back next time, won't we, Claire?
Bye-bye. Bye.
Did you catch that reference to the English-Hungarian writer David Soloy there? He was one of the novelists Alan Hollinghurst recommended to us back in May.
Well, Soleil's latest novel, Flesh, went on to win the Booker Prize. And if you're wanting to track down this or any of the many books we mentioned there, never fear. We always list them all on the Bookshelf program page. I'm Kate Evans, and I'll be back with Cassie McCullough next week with more books and writers. Join us again then, won't you?
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.